This is Dr. Batts. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm your host, and I'm in the studio today. I'm honored to be in the studio with Baba Dr. Onaje Muid. You are a man that I've known for over 25 years. Have been a student of yours, have been a follower, a friend, a son, love your work, the impact that you have globally, and have really wanted to introduce you to the listeners so that they can learn more about you, your work, the theories. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So we're going to jump right into this with the question is, who are you?
Wow. I guess that's a spiritual question in that we all are on the journey of finding who we are. So just ask me, who am I? I'm on that journey. I will say that my mother, Sylvia Oliver, who will be 92 in November of this year, God willing, and my father was Thomas Oliver. So coming from the Olivers, and my mother's maiden name was Taylor, so they give you some genealogy, son of Thomas Oliver and Sylvia Oliver. And I guess my name would give some indication of this journey that I'm on of life and how it has unfolded. So Onaje is the sensitive one, owner of the feeling. Jua is son, Rojo, spiritual, and also is that is he who tires not from the efforts to enhance life.
That sounds about right.
And at this moment, I can't even think of that name. And that's because I'm going through serious struggle in terms of a nephew that just passed away. And if I understand correctly, to get confirmation that his mother just passed away, and I just got that call moments ago.
Wow.
So
what's your nephew's name?
Jelani.
Jelani and his
Jelani's
mother?
Zenobia's aide. Zenobia's aide. I wasn't even planning to bring this into the conversation, but I see that it's affected me in such a fashion I can't even remember a name and attribute. And then Abdul Muid is a servant of God, the Restorer, Osundu. That's the Osundu's one who tires not from the efforts and to improve or enhance life. So as African, as a manifested soul in this African body, I've been trying to understand all the dimensions of, we say ourselves, but I guess it's different parts of ourselves, right? We are a spiritual being having a human experience, but in that human experience, it gives a lot of context. And over the years, I've attempted to understand what it is to be African in this world at this time and be about the conquest of liberation.
Powerful. Are you up for this?
Yeah, yes, I'm definitely up for this.
What message do you have for the people? I mean, we usually end there, but something is asking me to start there because you've got some heavy stuff on your heart.
I guess the message at this point is those who you love and respect, really be with them and spend time with them because you just don't know. In addition to having to mourn the loss of Jelani's aide and, if I understand correctly, Zenobia's aide, his mother, and all that which the family is going through, I lost another friend just yesterday, a mentor of mine, Hakeem Anderson. And Hakeem Anderson was this brother who lived at least 9 different lives, you know, in terms of what he did, but always for the liberation of black people, for the advancement of humanity. So coming up, driving from the Philadelphia area, a small town called Lansdowne, driving up, I was on the phone with Ralph, his good friend, for about an hour and a half. In fact, I just finished getting off the phone with him. And my intention, after I heard of Hakeem's passing, may Allah be pleased, I had wanted to go over to the house because Hakeem was living technically in Ralph's house, his mother's house in Philadelphia, and I was planning to go over there yesterday. But at the end of the conversation with Ralph, I had said that even though my intention was to be with you to see if you needed me to move anything around in the house, the task was still the same, but the place was different. It wasn't the physical house, actually, it was his mind, because it gave him relief to be able to share with me his relationship with Hassan, with Hassan.
Hakeem.
And I'm talking, hour and a half, he's just talking about this life and he's crisscrossing this and he's telling me this and telling me this. And we had a phenomenal time. So it's Jelani, it's Zenobia, it's Hakeem. All this is happening at the same time.
All at once, lots of loss.
At the same time. So it's given me deep reflection of life. And of course, these things can also prompt one to think about one's own life, or one's own, you know, finality. So being at the age of 71, you know, any day is the day, could happen. So you want to put some things in place. So I would say the second message is, make a list, you know, of these 10 things that you have to do. Have a will. I'm still creating a family trust, right? So have all those things in place so when we do make our transition, it'll be easier on those who we're leaving behind.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we don't pay attention to those things. And we don't intend to create stress or problems. You know,
but our inaction creates it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm present to those things. I've been thinking about it, but now it's, of course, that much more on my mind.
Yeah, these things are right in front of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you mentioned that Brother Hakeem or Rahimullah had lived many lives. In the time that we have left, what lives have you lived that you want to talk about? Like your journey. How did you get here?
Yeah, okay. So I remember reading the book Death at an Early Age by Jonathan Corzo. And it was talking about black boys dying in Boston. Death at an Early Age. I think that was the first book that really just opened me up to, maybe I might have been in the 10th grade. And fast forward, graduating Dwight Morrow High School in Englewood, New Jersey, being in the senior play and getting this pulled into the theater, working with Ernie McClintock out of Harlem, New York, Afro-American Studios for Acting and Speech, and then being told that Alvin Ailey was hiring a light and sound technician trainee. Traveled with Alvin for about 2 years, came back to New York City, went to Harlem College Adapted Program, then went into engineering school. So all these different places were giving me, meeting people, opening my mind up, being a member of what was called the East Organization, a black nationalist organization in Brooklyn, New York. While in Brooklyn studying engineering, spending more time at the East than I did at Pratt Institute. So when I left Brooklyn, didn't have my bachelor's degree in engineering, but I had a PhD, I thought so, in black nationalism. Also, let me say that after high school, seeing the play Elhaj Malik El Shabazz, Malcolm became a major influence, a prototype, in fact. And the other person was George Jackson, reading prison letters and Blood in My Eyes. So those two men became my model of who I would want to be as a man. And
Malcolm X and George Jackson?
And George Jackson.
Wow. Yeah. Those are huge shoes to fill.
Yeah, yeah. And then reading Emeka Cabral, Return to the Source, different people along the way, and then meeting people who were actually living like that, like Irvin Davis became a mentor of mine, co-founder of Patrice Lumumba Coalition, and executive director of the Pan-African Skills Project, Ilambe Brath, also co-director, co-founder of Patrice Lumumba Coalition.
You dropped some heavy names, man.
These are the people who influenced my life. Imari Obadeli, you know, founder of the Republic of New Africa. So meeting these people and getting educated from them just pushed me forward. And then meeting Yusef Klei, who was the the founder of ICHRAM, International Human Rights Association for American Minorities, was also Malcolm X's chairperson of the OAU in Canada, and then I became his alternate UN representative. So my profession has been basically in the field of social work, in fact, but my avocation has been human rights. So those are the two things that really has shaped how I think and how I move and how I create. Most of my life has been dedicated to the healing of African people from the Ma'afa that we are still experiencing.
Right. Say a little bit about this Ma'afa.
Ma'afa is a key Swahili word that means great tragedy. And when we talk about Jews and the Holocaust, right, the word that most black people are starting to use around the world is the Ma'afa. And it's looking at our kidnap, transport, enslavement, and then colonization. So we're living in micro colonies. Dr. Martin Luther King said that black people are living in colonies. And not too many people know that. And of course, Malcolm X had the same understanding. But once we understand the political structure in which we're living, then we'll know what has to be done. And that is to say, you can't solve macro problems on an individual level.
Mm-hmm.
And so programs are helpful, but it's not what's needed. What's needed is, in fact, is a cultural revolution where we begin to free our minds so that we can free our value systems, free our behaviors, and free our communities.
And where do we begin?
We begin with acknowledge our own hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledge our own trauma,
mm-hmm.
and just owning it, saying this is true, this is, mm-hmm. and that's painful, because sometimes the trauma we have to talk about is the trauma that was happened by a family member.
Someone that was supposed to care for us.
Somebody that's supposed to care for us. The concept we use is called the abandoning authority.
Mm-hmm.
We have, with the presence of the abandoning authority, not only does the pain and trauma happen in the first instance, it's continued. So we are gaining control of ourselves in such a manner to be in relationship. You gave me a book, a journal, and it says that healing happens in communities and in relationships, which is really, that's the all of it. That's the key of it. That's, the relationships, the healthy relationships, which I call social ecology.
Social ecology. Yeah, healing begins in authentic relationships and within community. We emphasize that.
And with that is, we have to be each other's liberation medicine.
That's right. We have to be in right relationship with ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you begin to have these external relationships when the sickness is within you? We have work to do. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about this idea that you continue to emphasize, that it is village time. What does it look like to restore the village? What does it look like to build the village? And some of your specific work that you're doing in those areas, all right? You are listening to Let's Talk. This is Dr. Hassan Betts. I'm in the studio with Baba Dr. Onaje Mawid, and we'll be right back after a short break.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY, Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11, offers many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus Swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. This is Dr. Hassan Betts. We are in the studio with Baba Dr. Onaje Mawid, one of my friends, one of my fathers, one of my mentors, teachers. It is phenomenal to have you here. Thank you for joining us. You're talking about several losses that you've just experienced within the village, within your village. And for this second segment, I really want to talk about this idea. You always tell me it's village building time, that it's village time. At one point it was nation time, and now it's village time. What does that mean for our listeners that are not familiar with that language, those concepts? What does it mean to restore the village?
I think when we hear the word village, we think of a pretty intimate space where everybody knows each other.
Mm-hmm.
People care for each other. When my wife and I, Dr. Fatima Hafiz, when we do talks, often we'll use three greetings. first from South Africa, I see you, and sometimes that can be interpreted as that we see you. And then the second greeting is from the Dogon, it says, God sent you, how's your health?
Mm-hmm.
And then the third is from Maasai. When they meet each other, they say, how are the children? So when we finally see each other and appreciate what we're seeing and valuing what we're seeing, it's going to give us the ability to care, to want to care for that person, right? If you don't see a person, how can you care for that person? You have to see them first.
That's right.
After you see them, the next level of compassion is that you are concerned about them, mental, physical, spiritual, social. So we said, God sent you, how's your health, your mental health, your spiritual health? And that's you're in a relationship, and you're starting to do things with each other in such a fashion that both of your qualities of life can be existed, can be increased. And then, of course, Maasai, how are the children? Yes, we want to know how are the children, the physical children in our space and time, but also what is our future? How is that connected to what we're thinking? Our Indigenous brothers talked about seven generations, right? We have to think seven generations forward.
That's easier said than done.
It is. It is, particularly for people who have been placed in perpetual poverty. So some families have the inheritance of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Other families have the inheritance of poverty. And the question becomes, how do you break those cycles? Those cycles can only be broken when people pull themselves together. You said, let's pull together, which is a key Swahili word, harambe. Pull together. And very simply, we can start with this seven principles of Kwanzaa, of umoja, unity, kujijakalia, self-determination, ujima, collective work and responsibility, ujamaa, cooperative economics, nia, purpose.
So you're saying those principles, that these principles can help us restore the village?
Yes.
And we don't just have to do them during the days of Kwanzaa?
No, it should not be only in the day of Kwanzaa. Kwanzaa should be the elevation, and Kwanzaa should be the time when we can recall what has happened through the year, from one year to the next, and how did you understand umoja, unity, so forth and so on, imani, faith. So Kwanzaa becomes a time of assessment and re-editing and then recasting, right, what's going to happen for the next year, right? Because Kwanzaa means harvest.
That's right.
So there's the Isley Brothers song, When will there be a harvest? And this is what we're looking for, a harvest. I often speak about humans have four possibilities and four possibilities only. That is, they can agree, they can build relationship, they can be empowered, they can power each other, and then they can experience abundance. So you can see a people who, in any relationship, that it's not an agreement, that's violence.
That's right.
Any situation where there's not relationship, then it's isolation.
Mm.
We already
knew this. However, the Surgeon General has just said that loneliness is a public health epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, like last couple of weeks, he also said that gun violence is a public health epidemic. Nothing new to us. However, I think it affirms it for externally for people. So now there's been an investment and a real look at this idea of belonging and community and the village.
So you have to understand that for people to oppress another people, they have to take that aspect away.
What's that?
They have to take away. If you're saying that isolation is a problem, well, oppression can only continue through isolation.
That's right. That's right.
So when people are together in their thinking, if they're together in their actions, that creates resistance.
That's right.
Against someone else who's trying to exploit them and is trying to take advantage of them. So
it's a protective factor, right? Community is a protective factor.
Indeed. Being in relationship with one another. So the question was, how does this relate to villageosity? Village, which I call villageosity, is on a very micro level, starting to knit those relationships together in such a way that they are meaningful,
mm-hmm.
That they are reparative,
mm-hmm.
and that they are constructive. So I work with Promise Neighborhood of Lehigh Valley.
Shout out to Promise Neighborhood.
The work that you're doing there is incredible. And I'm only just really repeating what I've experienced. working for Face Piggyback, which is a small company in Harlem, New York, which is, the character has changed dramatically from the time that it was founded and the time that I was there from 1986 to 2000.
Okay.
And we dealt with the concept of resocialization. Yes, people were using drugs, but we didn't say that they need treatment. What we said is that they need resocialization to balance the mental, the physical, and the spiritual, to create a self-empowered individual. So that which I learned there, that which I practiced there, was able to set the template as I started to work with other organizations and still feeling that because when people came to the center, they stayed there all day. The only time they can leave is if they had a medical appointment, a legal appointment, or education appointment. Other than that, we expected them to be there. So we had a village concept of resocialization. It wasn't just treatment. And then, of course, when managed care came into the picture, they gave people the option, well, you can go to a center where you can only go there for 1 hour of counseling or 2 or 3 hours group, and then you can go home. Well, guess what? People will opt to do that because they have been taught to deny themselves the resources that they need. So when you give people that type of option, it's very easy for them to say, oh, yeah, just give me that option. And it really destroyed the model, and the people suffered.
You can see it. Having been a part of it, you see the difference.
Big difference, big difference.
So where do we go from here, just in general? How do we get to where we need to be? We know how we got here.
Mm-hmm.
What's next?
Well, we don't really know. What's a lot of things is just so left out. I've just talking to a historian, Daoud, but he's writing a book on the thousands of our people who escaped from the plantation.
Mm-hmm.
But we've never told that. So there's a whole narrative that we haven't been given and has not therefore nourished our ability to resist. Because if you can convince a people that it's hopeless for them to do X, Y, and Z, they will do those things. And the way that you make people hopeless is that you deny them the examples of that thing being done, which is our history. We've been not denied our history. So we can look at the work of Schomburg, Arthur Schomburg, right, who created the Schomburg Center. It wasn't really him. It was really his wife. Even though he assembled the books, it was his wife who actually negotiated the contract with New York City library system to actually start and, you know, initiate the Schomburg collection. So we really have to go back to our history and pull it together. But history alone isn't the answer, because how do you then take that knowledge and turn it into that which you're doing with your life? So there's a difference between history and heritage. So it's not enough to know Black history. Black history can only be useful when it becomes Black heritage, when we internalize it and then we live it. And we advance it.
Okay.
So much of the Black History programs are good attempts, but it has to have the, we have to move from awareness to acceptance to application.
And we're still focusing on awareness.
Sometimes we think awareness is enough. It's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
I used the work of Mari Evans to say, she says, if you make a people mystified, dependent, subordinate, and powerless, you've colonized them. So we're in the process of decolonization, which means we have to move towards education, move towards self-reliance, move towards self-affirmation, and move towards self-determination. There is a brother, Siwipe, who now lives in Guinea-Bissau. He was able to trace his lineage all the way back to Guinea-Bissau, where he lives. And he is saying that where do we go from here? We have to create a body of African-centered diplomats to represent us. Without a people having a sense of their collective identity, right, which usually is called a nation, without a people having a sense of nation of themselves who would be in concert with people who think like them, have similar kind of backgrounds and similar kind of aspirations, if you deny people that level of collective strength and collective identity, they'll function as individuals. So, you know, we've all been told that you can't fight City Hall. That is saying that individuals can't fight against organized entities.
Mm-hmm.
So only by us becoming organized will we begin to appreciate who we are and start to build the kind of institution that you're building that Promised Neighborhood to give us a sense of identity, a sense of purpose, and a sense of direction.
It's not easy.
No, it's not, but it's beautiful, though. When you find those people who are willing, I mean, every time I come up to Promised Neighborhood, my spirit is uplifted. Yes, first, in the first instance of what is called the radical welcome, but after you come through the door and people are clapping to see you, but the conversations that happens after that, Promised Neighborhood has become a haven for me. Mm. So where do we go from here? Reproduce what's happening at Promised Neighborhood as many places as we can.
And how do we do that?
Come to the table and agree to agree and say, this is our plan. So if you're meeting in your living room, if you're meeting at the library, it's starting to create collective cells, if you will, collective units where people are sharing their life, their narrative, their story, and their hopes and their dreams.
And even before that, in families, right? Like,
yes.
Families coming together, partners coming together. I mean, there seems to be like, This disconnect has really been pushed to untether us from our individual humanity and our collective humanity, mm-hmm. our relationships.
Interesting that you say family. Thank you for that. I work as a public health social worker in the field of infant and maternity prevention. And many of those services, as the fatherhood coordinator, I work with the men, which makes sense, right? And many of the women work with the women in terms of the pregnancy, the birth, and the postpartum period. But what's absent from that stage is a family-centered approach. Mm-hmm. So by you saying family, and it's reminding me of a conversation I was having last night with a researcher who has done a lot of work on terms of fatherhood and research. And now I need to become aware of that body of literature and see how it can work. And she was saying to me, and once I get that information, I'll bring it to your attention, that the federal government is launching a whole campaign of developing family cohesion. And she's saying that they're putting some large dollars out. So it could be a place in which Promised Neighborhood could participate and bring, continue to bring that family-centered approach to your work. And if I remember correctly,
sounds exciting.
If I remember correctly, Promised Neighborhood speaks about being Black-led,
that's right,
anti-racist, women-centered,
that's right,
liberation-based, and community-based. And this group that I met through you in Puerto Rico, I looked at their website, and they say that health, you know, of a people starts with the health of the woman. Mm. I'm paraphrasing it. So,
yeah, yeah.
So it's my intention to go to Puerto Rico next week to bathe myself in bumba, which is the African rhythm, particularly in Puerto Rico, where they have a bumba festival. Mm-hmm. So with all the trauma that I'm experiencing now and the hurt and the loss, I'm going to...
be with your people.
I'm going to be with those rhythms.
We thank you for coming out, Baba J. That's our time, man. We don't have to do this again. Anything in closing that you want to share?
We are each other's liberation medicine. And look at the film Dope is Death that features the life of Dr. Mutulu Shakur, one of my heroes and mentors from a distance. And just dive into We Are Each Other's Liberation Medicine.
We are each other's liberation medicine. Tupac used to shout out Dr. Mutulu Shakur, that was his stepfather or something like
that's
that, right?
Yes.
One of his elders, man. Mm-hmm. So he has poured into a lot of warriors in our community. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And take what you need with your friends. Losses is not easy, man. We love you and we appreciate you, bro.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Best. You're listening to Let's Talk. Until next time, know that we are each other's liberation medicine.
If you enjoyed this program, you can hear this episode and more, along with our other public affairs programming at wdiy.org, on WDIY's free mobile app, on your favorite podcast platform or live weekdays from 6 to 7 p.m. here on WDIY.